Hi, welcome to a responsible day for the 28th day of Adar Sheni. Let me just briefly take you a little bit behind the scenes of this podcast of a responsible day and point out that Adar Sheni is a month that came about in the third year after I started recording these. I started recording a certain year, and that year we did 5 a week, and then the next year, so I'm now at Hanukkah of Tufshin Ayin Chet of 5778. So that year I was finishing up the ones I hadn't done yet, including Adar Sheni, but there's no Adar Sheni until Tufshin Ayin Tet, until the next year. So if you've been listening at all to these, and I assume by coming in here you're listening to them, then these are actually the end ones of it, even though you may have started at at Sivan or at Tishrei or whenever you may have started. This is actually the latest ones of the ones that are being recorded. So as I thank for some of the last times in this series, Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hochhauser, and the OU, it is with the full weight of the thank you and the gratitude that I owe to them. My name is Gideon Rothstein, for their role in assisting us together and being able to learn these issues together. So today's response of 28th of Adar Sheni is from Shut Ezrat Kohen, from the response of Rav Cook of Rav Avraham Cohen Cook. This is the Evan Ezer response, the ones that have to do with relations between men and women, husbands and wives. Response number 14. And it's written on the 28th of Adar Sheni of Tafresh Ayin Gimel of 5773, which would have been 1913, so just a little bit over 100 years ago. And he's writing to Yedid Yakar, a good friend, Ben Sion Uziel. So Ben Sion Uziel would later become, I think at this point he might have, I don't think he was yet the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he's a very young man, he's 33 years old. Now the people who become Rav Uziel in their later lives, when they're 33, are also very impressive people. So he writes to his good friend Rav Uziel, who it says, who Choneb Irene, who lives there in Tel Aviv Yafo. I think Rav Cook at this point is the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv Yafo, and Rav Uziel is an important Talmud Chacham, a young, budding, but already significant Talmud Chacham. And they're discussing the case. Rav Uziel has written to Rav Cook about the case, or discussed it, and then Rav Cook wrote it up, discussing the case of a woman, who sadly became, now, may mean that she thought they got married, but halakhically we don't recognize that marriage anyway because she's Jewish, and so there's no such thing as marriage, but it may mean they just chose to live together, although I did not know that in 1913 there were people who just chose to live together. But part of the lessons, one of the lessons of reading, a bunch of responses, over, I guess, 300 responses together, is that things that we think of as being new and completely different and strange and never happened before, all of this stuff has happened, or much of this stuff has happened in various forms and various times in human history. It is, the longer I have lived on this earth, the more and more. I recently wrote an article with that title, that Shlomo Melech never wrote truer words than Ein Chadash Tachat HaShemesh. It's something new under the sun. It looks new and it seems different. We fool ourselves it's different and new, but the basic rhythms, the basic patterns of Jewish history, of human history, in their technology and in their merits and their great things that they do, and in their, sadly, other things that they do, it's all just sort of a wheel that comes around in various forms. So the question here is, this woman had been in this relationship with a non-Jew, and now she's come out of the relationship, and she wants to get married. Right, so I don't know how it happened that she met, it could be that her relationship with this non-Jew was on the rocks and she met a guy who was Jewish, she wants to marry him. But there is in halacha a requirement that a woman who leaves one relationship, however that happens, and is going to enter another relationship, we require 3 months separation between the two in halacha. The reason we require 3 months separation is to know the lineage of any baby that might come out of that. So in this case, it would be, she leaves this relationship, if a month later she marries a Jew and then she turns out to be pregnant, we won't be confident or positive whether it was the non-Jew who impregnated her or the new Jewish husband or relationship that impregnated her. That's true for widows. We have that situation, right? Because you want to be sure whether or not the child that comes out, and this is not only a Yibum issue, it's not only when she's currently childless or the man who passed away is currently childless, and we want to know if there is a child to know whether there's Yibum or Chalitza. It's true even if she already had kids, but she's not supposed to get married again for 3 months afterwards, so we can know who the new children, who any new children would come, would be, who their lineage would be. So here, Rav Cook says, you got to have the same thing. Shehi pilegesh mamash, because her relationship with this non-Jew, which was a a sole relationship. It was an exclusive relationship. That's what I'm looking for. It was an exclusive relationship. Whatever her standing mean, I don't think she was married to him, but it was well known that they were living together exclusively. So the halacha in Shulchan Aruch Samach Zayin 67 is Ditzricha Havakana, that any time a woman is in a relationship, an exclusive relationship with a man, and that relationship ends, she's going to need to wait for Havakana, and there's a Tshuva of the Ran and the Rivash, which Rav Kook is going to mention later in this response. He's going to mention, he doesn't have that Ran and Rivash in front of him. He can't consult them originally, but that's where the Shulchan Aruch has it. And the Shulchan Aruch, they tell you some of the sources they got. So now he says, and I mean, this is, I think, the piece that maybe of Uziel was not positive about. It doesn't matter to us whether it was a non-Jew that she had a relationship with or a Jew, meaning you might have assumed that if she's had a relationship with a non-Jew, she'll be extra careful not to get pregnant because she doesn't have a baby by a non-Jew, maybe. But Rav Kook says, Kevanshi schemely techelo, as soon as a woman agrees to have an exclusive relationship with a man, da'ata gam kein lehitaber. It is her intent also to get pregnant. Now, that's one of those examples of, we have many of them in halacha, where important halachists make comments about human nature, make comments about the expectations of people, and I always wonder to myself, which of those, I think there are both types, which of those are statements about the inherent nature of human beings, and which of those are women in this case, and which of those are socially or culturally dependent? So I think that's an interesting question. I know that there's famous situation of Rabbi Soloveitchik claiming, Zechus HaLevracha, assuming and asserting that there are statements that Chazal make about the nature of women that Rabbi Soloveitchik thought were meant as assertions of eternal elements of, you know, the female nature, as opposed to other elements, the eternal elements of the male nature. I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm saying that's a question to think about. In this case, when Rav Kook says it, she intends to be mitaber, what if she could bring proof that she'd been on the pill? Would we then require havkana? So I think Rav Kook would think yes, but then this part of it would go away, because then you know that it wasn't data leitaber. Now, the Rambam did say, the Beit Shmuel points out that the Rambam did say that a woman who's having a promiscuous relationship, a znut relationship, so a znut relationship is one where a woman's having, you know, regular sexual activity perhaps, but there's no sense of relationship, there's no sense of connection there. So the assumption was that she would take, and this would be like something like going on the pill, going on contraception, but the Gemara's example was she would find ways to make sure that she did not get impregnated. So Rav Kook says, that's true about a person who's in a znut relationship. So a znut relationship would be the woman's living on her own somewhere. She meets up with guys. She has relations with them. So there we would assume she takes precautions to the extent that she can not to get pregnant. And therefore, it might be that if she wants to get married to somebody, she doesn't need to have 3 months because we have no reason to think that she got pregnant. But with a pilegesh, the reason the word pilegesh is translated to English as concubine, but in halachic terms, a pilegesh means, and that's why I think they weren't actually married, a pilegesh means a woman who has an exclusive relationship with a man, but there's not the full, there's all debate among the Rishonim about the definition of pilegesh, but there wasn't the full, it wasn't fully made up a marriage. So there might have been an agreement, like a sort of a prenuptial agreement. There might have been agreement about what would happen if the relationship broke up. There might have been, not a kiddushin in that formal sense, but there might have been an agreement there would be exclusive. It's unclear, but in the case of a pilegesh, so Rav Kook thinks that that's included in the usual decree, in the usual rule, that a woman who ends a relationship, that when the relationship, a woman is in a relationship that ends, doesn't matter who ends it, when a woman is, and it doesn't matter how it ends, whether it's by death or by them separating from each other, that she needs to wait 3 months so we can know who any ensuing babies come from. Now, the Rambam thinks that when it comes to a pilegesh, that it's not permitted. The Rambam thinks that ordinary people are not permitted to have pilegesh. The Rambam defines a pilegesh, so there's a debate among the Rishonim. The Rambam defines a pilegesh as a woman who gets no ketubah, there's no promise of what will happen to her, meaning there's no arrangement for what happens to her if that relationship ends, and she has no kiddushin, she has no formal halachic process that prohibits to her and anybody else. She just becomes one of the king's, you know, designated women that the king goes to. So why a woman would do that? I think it's because he's the king and there's, you know, and there's some pride in that and there's some prestige in that, but it's a complicated situation. But the Rambam thinks that that arrangement of pilegesh is only permitted to kings. And that would mean then that according to the Rambam, that if she, a woman enters into such a relationship with somebody other than a king, that she is violating, according to the Rambam, the Ravid disagrees about this, but the Rambam thinks that there's also a biblical prohibition. When the Torah says, Lo tiyek kidesha b'vno Israel, so the usual translation, Lo tiyek kidesha b'vno Israel, is that a Jewish woman can't be a prostitute. A kidesha would be a woman set aside for promiscuous relationships. But the Rambam holds that that includes any time that a Jewish woman has relations with a man who is not her husband at the time that she's having the relationship, meaning extramarital means like she's already married, but non-marital relations, according to the Rambam, is not only, it's a problem because it's zunut, it's promiscuity, but the Rambam thinks it's a biblical problem. It's a problem of a violation of a prohibition in the Torah of Kedesha. Why is that important for us? You might have thought that since, at least according to the Rambam, she's violating the Torah at a biblical level, she's fully violating the Torah in these relations that she's doing, she will take the same precautions as we said before a non-married woman would take. In other words, when we said a non-married woman who has no relationship with the man she's having relations with, who she's now having sexual relations with, but she has no formal relationship with him and she doesn't intend to have a continued relationship with him, that kind of a woman, we assume in halacha, takes precautions to avoid pregnancy. And we're willing to assume that those precautions are generally effective. Right? So we today have contraception, but we're willing to assume in halacha for centuries that women knew how to take precautions that were generally effective to avoid pregnancy. Whether or not that's scientifically true is not our issue right now. That's our halachic assumption. Therefore, any woman who has relations like that, if she says, I took precautions, we're not going to require her to wait 3 months. Meaning, let's say, to think of, you know, I've made a lot of TV references in these shiurim. Maybe I shouldn't, but there was a whole storyline in a TV show called Friends where a couple breaks up. The man is upset. He goes to a bar, meets a woman. He has a relationship with her that night. Then the next day, he theoretically could have gotten back together with his girlfriend, but she finds out about it and they have all problems and whatever it is. So if you reverse that for a second, if a woman broke up with her long-term boyfriend, was distraught about it, now, and long-term boyfriend, let's say she's not, but not an exclusive one, whatever that, but she's distraught about it, she goes to a bar, she has one time relationship with somebody else, so there, halakhically, we're allowed to assume, and then the next day, she and the boyfriend make up, and they decide to get married, we wouldn't require 3 months of separation, because we think she effectively managed to avoid pregnancy. That's what we would generally assume. So what about this woman? So this woman is in a relationship. She's a pilega. She has an exclusive relationship with this non-Jew, and therefore we would think she needs 3 months of separation to verify that she was not pregnant. But you might argue that since that whole relationship, first of all, it's a non-Jew, so it's prohibited, but since that whole relationship is also non-marital because it's not shaped by a marriage ceremony of any sort, and it's, according to the Rambam, a violation of the Torah, you might have thought that she would also take the same precaution, that she would realize that this isn't really a sanctioned relationship, it isn't a relationship that halacha really validates, and therefore that she would take precautions of the same sort that we should think of as effective, and therefore if she ends the relationship and then comes to us and says, I want to marry so-and-so Jew, we shouldn't make her wait 3 months. Rav Kook, however, says, Kevan she'niyachadalo enena bichlal b'sana shemitaper. He thinks it's not true. He says, once there's an exclusive relationship, the rest of the context that halacha applies to that relationship doesn't matter. A woman in a relationship that she thinks of as a relationship will not take the same precautions to avoid pregnancy. And that's true, by the way, he says, even if she was not nechiyachadai, he says alpinimus, meaning even if there's no legal, forget religious context or construct to this as being a marital relationship, even if there's no civil way of thinking of this as a formal relationship, Rav Kook thinks that once it's an exclusive relationship, basically once they're living together, then she needs havchana. She needs to wait 3 months so we can know where any baby, if she turns out to be pregnant, we can know that baby came from the non-Jew and deal with it that way rather than coming from the later relationship with the Jew that she has. And some authorities think that requirement of waiting 3 months is a biblical one. So according to them, this would be a biblical situation as well, and she would be violating the Torah if she chose to get married. Now, by the way, it's unclear to me about how people work their religiosity, right? If this is a woman who's just in a relationship for a long-term relationship with a non-Jew, an exclusive one, it's unclear to me why we would assume that she would care that much about the Torah. But people do such things, right? There are people who grew up in observant homes, and the observance is really all there within them, but they get upset about something, and they do some crazy set of actions, they later come fully back. And then there are people who are largely not observant at all, but some particular area of halacha resonates with them, and they keep that very carefully. So this is what Rav Kook's talking about. So, you know, it could be, if you said to her, it's a biblical violation to get married before 3 months from now, she might follow that, and that's what he's talking about. Now, Rav Kook says, and by the way, we have good reason to think that when she was, so part of the argument that Rav Uziel was making was maybe that since it's not a really formal relationship, maybe it's not, since it's not a marriage, maybe we can trust that she did what a mizana would do, that we can trust that she had took the same precautions against pregnancy that women who are promiscuous, having, you know, casual relationships would do as well, according to the halacha. So Rav Kook says, we can know that that's not true. She already had a miscarriage in this relationship with this non-Jew. So that shows she wasn't taking precautions. Now, I could have imagined somebody saying, well, it just shows only that whatever precautions she took weren't so effective, but in 1913, maybe the precautions weren't so effective. So Rav Kook is clearly not assuming that that's true. Rav Kook is thinking the precautions are generally effective, and then seeing her get married and have a miscarriage, that must mean, get pregnant and have a miscarriage, means that she wasn't trying to stop herself from getting pregnant, and therefore we have every reason to think that we need a hafkana, we need for her to wait 3 months now to be sure that we know where a baby came from in terms of who the father was. And as it happens, he quotes the Muram, I don't know who that is, might be the Rabbi Rittenberg, anyway, who held that, in fact, we require hafkana even from casual relationships, meaning this whole, the basic discussion until now has been that in a casual relationship, we can trust her to take effective measures to avoid pregnancy. Rav Kook says that's not a universally held opinion as well. There are those who hold that even from a casual relationship, we would require her to wait 3 months before she would get married. Now, a leniency he is willing to entertain is that perhaps we can say that we count the 3 months not from when she left the home where she was living with him, but from the time they no longer had relations with each other, from the time they stopped having sexual relations. How are you going to know when they stopped having sexual relations? We'll get to that in a second. Meaning, one option would be that she'll tell us, well, we were fighting, and so for 5 weeks before we broke up, we never had sex, and we could believe her. That would be one option. We'll get to that. Of course, we'll talk about whether we can get to that. But another option would be easily, you know, if he went on a business trip for 5 weeks before they broke up, and sometime in the course of the business trip where, you know, she said, oh, I've had enough, and she left the home. So could you count from? So you, ordinarily, we require counting from the time in a marriage, from when the marriage ended, when she left the household. But here, because after all, it wasn't a marriage, it was a pilegus arrangement, it was less formal than a full marriage, maybe there's room to let her count from the earlier date. So if Cook says there are two issues here, one is that since in a marriage, we require them to wait, the waiting starts only with the giving of the get, the giving of the bill of divorce, even though clearly they haven't had relations for a while before the divorce was given, we don't allow that kind of calculation to occur in a marriage at all. The get is what starts the 3 month waiting period. And since we said the Ran and the Rivash had held that we treat a pilegish, a concubine relationship, which means basically living together relationship, as like a marriage for these purposes, so step number one is, can you differentiate them? If we're going to treat it like a marriage, doesn't that mean that we have to treat it fully like a marriage, even though it's obviously very different? That would be question number one. And there's not going to be the need for a get, for a bill of divorce. He might have argued, right? You can go either way. He's not saying which way he goes, but you can go either way. You could say, well, since the Ran and the Rivash treat it like a marriage, we have to treat it like a marriage, and it's not until they actually broke up formally, she left the household, that we start counting the 3 months. Or you could say, since there's never going to be a get, we don't have to assume that it falls into that level of marriage, it becomes like marriage in that fullest sense. And then the second question would be, he says, do we trust the woman? Meaning, I gave you an example where it wouldn't be a question of trusting the woman about when they stepped out of a relationship, because if he went on a business trip and he was out of the house, you know, out of the country, that would be pretty good proof if we were going to allow that. But Rav Kook is saying, but even do we trust her? Meaning, let's say if this woman comes to Rav Uziel and says, you know, it's so terrible, I was in this relationship, I was living with this non-Jew, and then we started fighting, and 4 weeks later I said, fine, I've had enough, and I left, and the whole time we didn't have relations. Can we believe her and start the 3 month count then? Or can we not believe her? Meaning, even if we assume that a pilegesh relationship, this living together relationship, doesn't count as a marriage so fully that we would necessarily have to make her wait, but can we trust her about when they stopped having relations such that we can start the waiting, that we can start the clock from then? So Rav Kook points out that in a formal marriage situation, even when it's a marriage with a non-Jew, there's room to understand that you need a full hafkana if it's been a formal marriage. And he says, because that's the Rambam talks about it in the laws of a Yifat Tohar. So Yifat Tohar is a non-Jewish woman who's taken captive in war, and the Jewish man decides that he likes her, and whatever it is. So the Yifat Tohar will need a 90-day waiting period so that we can know whether or not she still had, you know, had been impregnated by, you know, her husband from when she was still in the non-Jewish realm. And the Rambam goes out of his way to tell us that the 30 days that the Jewish husband can do with it, that she wears, you know, that she makes herself look not as good as she could and all those things that Yifat Tohar does, count as part of the 90. So why does it tell us it counts as part of the 90? Because even though those, we know for sure that she hasn't had a relationship with her husband because she's not even in her husband's house, she's been taken captive. So therefore, it seemed like it says that, no, you need to have the days, you need to have from when she completely left the household. But with all that, and with all that, he thinks that pilegus to a nochri is even more serious of a situation, because there is no more formal marriage that there could be. right? The pilegish is the marriage. She calls man. As long as people think of her as being living with this guy and his you know his woman, then that's all part of the same gezera. Now here in this situation, it does say there's some room to say that maybe you could start counting a little earlier because she had had a miscarriage. So the miscarriage, you could say, Rav Kook suggests, you could say that we don't assume that she resumed relations right away because there's a health issue there. So if they broke up soon after the miscarriage, so then you might have said, well, maybe we can start counting from the miscarriage because we're pretty sure that after then, she never got pregnant again after that point. That's what he suggests, a possibility. But he doesn't think it's enough to rely on for two reasons. First, because there's a gzera here. Once there's a gzera, I mean, the gzera is that women who are married have to wait 3 months. That gzera about women who are married is independent of the possibility of pregnancy. It's a gzera that will do it in all cases, because you want to be sure that in case where there is a question, where there is a possibility that she got pregnant, that we'll know who the lineage comes from. It's not about, do we have reason to suspect? It's about, it's a gzera, it's a blanket decree. The only way that we were thinking of it, making an exception here was to say that she wasn't really married and therefore didn't fully fall under the gzera. But once we've decided that she falls under the gzera, then that's going to be a problem. And therefore, even though the miscarriage does in fact lead us to believe that they stopped relations at that point, or they had not started relations again by the time they broke up, and that should let us start the clock earlier on her havchana, her deciding, on our deciding when there's been 3 months that she waited so we can be sure that she gets married to a new Jewish man with a clean slate. If she counts as married, because this is the best you're going to get with a Jew and a non, not the best, because the worst you're going to get with a Jew and a non-Jew, in terms of what we'll define as marriage, because there is no marriage other than that, so then you can't consider it havkana, then you consider her fully under the requirement of the gzeira of havkana, that the need for waiting 3 months until she can marry somebody else. And then besides that, and this is, you know, an underlying question here is the whole thing. How can you trust her anyway? This is a woman who's chosen to live with a non-Jewish man, so apparently, she doesn't have any of our usual morality about these kinds of issues. Her cook says to her, who's Yale? So you can't really trust her. When she says, you know, we never started up again after the miscarriage, we have no reason to think that that's necessarily true, and we can't trust her statement about it. And therefore, Rav Kook thinks that there's no kula, there's no leniency here, and you have to and you have to have them wait. So you have to have this woman wait 3 months. But he says, by the way, I'm busy now, and I'm not really up to look into this stuff. And he also says, I haven't seen that Ran and the Rivash carefully. It could be that when you read the Ran and the Rivash, meaning he got the quote from the Shulchan Aruch, that they qualify these people, a Pilegesh, as a married woman. But he said, if we looked at the Ran and the Rivash, it could be that we would see words there that would teach us room for leniency. But I can't look at it now, and therefore I'm not ruling firmly on this issue, but that's what I think we have to do. Now he talks about a ger. Now I think at this point it turns out that the couple didn't break up so much. It's unclear to me. It seems to me like there's room to think that the ger here, the convert he's talking about right now, is the guy who had been living with this woman. I'm not positive about that. Meaning, it could be that I've been talking about them breaking up, but that really what happened was, after she had a miscarriage, it could be something like she decided that they were having trouble because he was not Jewish, and he agreed to convert, and now they want to get remarried once he's converted, and Rav Kook is talking about whether or not they have to wait the 3 months. But when it comes to the convert, Rav Kook says it's very difficult to find a head there to let him convert, because the way he acts, now it could be a different person. It could be just like a different case, but it sounds like it's the same case, because his actions all show that he has no interest in Judaism. He's not converting because he found religion, because he's come to realize that a Kaddish Baruch Hu runs the world and he wants to serve a Kaddish Baruch Hu in the best way possible. It's none of that. It's Shenatani Nabavai. So he sees this Jewish woman who he likes very much and he wants to marry her, and she says, I can't marry you unless she converts, and she wants to convert. So Rav Kook thinks that that's nothing that we can accept. This is an important topic that comes up all the time, and Rav Kook's words here, I think, are very useful to remind us of. And he quotes a Rambam. The Rambam writes in the 13th chapter of Hilchot Isuri Biyah that in the whole time of David and Shlomo, the courts didn't accept any converts. In the times of David, because of fear, they thought the people were converting because David was so militarily powerful. They said, I got to be linked up with that. In times of Shlomo, that because Shlomo had such a remarkable kingship, his monarchy was so impressive, that and it was so wealthy, that people would want to join because you want to be part of that, right? So success breeds people wanting to join, you know, front runners who want to join success. So Rambam says that the courts did not accept converts in that whole era, that whole time period, because those are not acceptable motive to convert. The way the Rambam writes it is, Shekola Chozer Min Ha'akum, anybody who is turning aside from idolatry, from paganism, and meaning wanting to join us, Bishvil Davar Mehevli Ha'olam, for some ulterior motive having to do with success in this world, that's not a Ger Tzedek. That is not the kind of convert that we look at and that we accept, that we think of. But then he adds there, but even so, people were so excited about conversion at the time, there were people who just convert on their own, as it were. They were mitgairim in the time. They wouldn't go to a court. They would be mitgairim. They would say, I converted. They would convert in front of, you know, three friends or whatever it was. They would convert. They would go to mikvah. They would have a brit milah. They'd say, I'm a convert. They would join the Jewish people. And the Rambam doesn't write that it doesn't work. Right? He's saying the courts aren't accepting them, but then people would be mitgairim themselves. The Rambam has a complicated calculation. He says the courts would be choshesh. They would worry about it. They wouldn't push them away, right? Once they'd gone to mikvah, and they wouldn't bring them close either, and at least that would happen. So he goes on, there's a whole halacha about that. That it gets complicated. If they have bad motives, they're really not Jewish. If they turn out to have good motives and they really stick with Jewish people, then it turns out that they are converts. So when it comes to this gear that Rav Ozi was asking about, Rav Cook says he thinks that you should try to stop them to the extent possible. And a real Beit Din shouldn't learn from the actions of regular people in regular courts who don't know what they're doing and are converting people who should be converted and doing the wrong thing. He says, you know, about 2 years ago, I was asked a similar question from the Jewish community in Egypt, and they asked me about a non-Jew who wanted to convert, and it was clear it was for marriage. He said, I was very troubled by it, and I was very troubled that they accepted this guy as a convert, and then it turned out that after he converted and got married, he's met a non-Jewish woman who he liked even better, and he left his wife, and then the rabbis at the time, and he left the wife and wasn't willing to divorce her halachically, because he said, I'm not Jewish anymore, I'm now a Muslim, I'm back to being a Muslim, back to being Christian, whatever it is, I'm not having anything to do with your Jewish ceremonies, because unfortunately divorcing can get bitter and upsetting. So the rabbis in Egypt now want to save this woman because they want to save her from Igun, because she's going to be stuck. She's going to be married to a Jewish man. So they wanted to say, you know what? Maybe it was never a good conversion. And Rav Cook says, and I didn't want to join them on that. No, I think he didn't want to join them on that because he thinks it was wrong of them to convert to begin with. But it's unclear. I think he said, and I think he's saying the Rambam would say we're not positive it's not a conversion. It might have been, because remember, if somebody converts sincerely and intends for all the best motives in the world, you can imagine this happening. A real Ger Tzedek, a real convert, has no connection to any Jew prior, has not done it for any of those reasons. And then 5 years down the road, something goes wrong in his or her life. And he says, ugh. And he blames it on, or she blames it on Judaism and leaves. Easily you can imagine that. You can imagine that because there are natural-born Jews who do such a thing, right? Who something goes wrong in their life, they blame it on Judaism, and they leave the religion. It's a terrible thing. But here's the more terrible part of it. Since the conversion was valid, they're leaving, that convert's leaving, does not help them. As far as we're concerned, halakhically, they're still Jewish. They've always been, they continue to be Jewish. So here too, I think that's where Rav Cook is pointing out. For all that he thought that conversion should not happen, it's not completely clear that it's an invalid conversion once a court does it, even if it's a court that shouldn't have done it, and then this one might really be stuck. And it's a reminder, says Rav Cook, he says it very clearly here and very, you know, strictly, it's a reminder of how it's easily possible that you have people, shelosh halofshim masveh al pneihem, they put a mask on their faces. He's saying to hunt down Jewish women. But I think what he means is you get attracted to a Jewish woman. How the laws of attraction work is a mystery to everybody. But let's say they're forbidden fruit, they're this or that. But they decide they really want a Jewish woman. They're really excited. They're really excited. They do the chase. And then afterwards, something happens. Either the chase got boring or just something else happens, because unfortunately, in some relationships, things go wrong. And then they decide to leave. So that creates a great deal of damage. And so Rav Cook says we have to be very, very careful about these things. So again, whether or not it's linked to the case he was talking about with this woman, whether she'd have to wait, it's a reminder of issues that come up in conversion, and that we need to be careful about who we do and don't convert, and that there are, you know, a lot of times people will say, well, you got to convert them to help them out because she's going to marry him anyway and you want to help them, and that's a whole set of poskim, of important poskim, who said in those situations we help them out, we let them convert. But Rav Cook is pointing out the flip side is that it can lead to terribly tragic situations and it might not be fully effective to begin with. And then the last little piece of the response is some Ashkenazim apparently come to Rav Uziel for a judgment. And Rav Cook says, you know, let them come to me a little bit. I'll see that if they really need you, I'll give them a harsha. I'll give them the right to judge before you, meaning that Rav Cook was, I think, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv Yafo at the time, and he was the man who they should have come for. Also, they're Ashkenazim, so they really should have been under his rubric. And therefore, he said they should come to me first. And if they have to come to me, he realized that it's reason for them to go to you, I'll let them go to you. So that is a correspondence between Rav Kook and Rav Ben Zion Meir Chai Uziel for the 28th day of Adar Sheni of Tav Reish Ayin Gimel. A correspondence between Rav Kook and Rav Uziel about a woman who unfortunately was living with a non-Jewish man, and about whether a non-Jew should be allowed to convert seemingly for the purpose of marriage. This has been a responsible day for 28th day of Adar Sheni. Thank you to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Romowitz, David Hochhauser, for putting these shirim online and making them available to you. Have a great day.